From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, they might be giants. The band's clever lyrics and catchy melodies have won a cult following, but they've also reached a mass audience through their theme songs for The Daily Show and Malcolm in the Middle. We'll talk with John Linnell and John Flansburgh, who have been performing together for about 20 years. Now they have a children's book called Bed, Bed, Bed that comes with a companion CD. Also, rock historian Ed Ward takes us back to the swingin' London of the 60s and the weird, funny music of the Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band. And film critic David Edelstein reviews In America from director Jim Sheridan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. forces in Iraq say they've taken people into custody in connection with guerrilla attacks on American-led troops. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the arrests are aimed at getting closer to finding Saddam Hussein.
We had two reports today, one of the arrest of one of Saddam Hussein's former bodyguards, Brigadier General Khalid Hatemi, and also yesterday the arrest of a wife and daughter of Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri, a top Saddam deputy who the military suspects of coordinating attacks against Americans. There's a $10 million reward out for al-Duri's capture. It's not clear if this detention of his family members will lead to his capture.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad. Secretary of State Colin Powell defended the Bush administration's decision to withhold about 3% of U.S. loan guarantees for Israel. The move is designed to show U.S. disapproval of Israel's settlement activities on the West Bank and of the security barrier Israel says it needs to keep Palestinian terrorists out of the country. Secretary Powell says it sends an important signal.
It's certainly a signal. It's not an insignificant amount of money. And the president has said on a number of occasions that the defense is a problem.
Israeli officials say they won't be hurt much by the reduction in loan guarantees. Palestinians say the U.S. penalty isn't big enough to affect Israeli policy. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said the U.S. is not putting any pressure on Israel, and a senior advisor to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said Israel will continue building the barrier. The statements came after the Bush administration announced it will trim almost $300 million from $9 billion in American loan guarantees to penalize Israel for continuing to build the barrier. Palestinian Cabinet Minister Saab Barakat said the American move does not go far enough. He said cutting the loan guarantees by such a small amount will not deter Israel. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The U.S. welcomed a vote today by the International Atomic Energy Agency condemning Iran for its secret research on nuclear weapons. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the resolution makes it clear that the agency won't tolerate any further violations of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Iran has been put on notice. Should there be any new information that comes to light or inaccuracies that come to light, then the board would take up the issue again and take appropriate action under the charter and the safeguards.
The U.S. had wanted the agency to report Iran to the U.N. Security Council. In stocks today, the Dow gained 16 points to close at 9,780 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 10 points. It closed at 1,953. This is NPR News. New York City has fired the captain of the Staten Island ferry that crashed last month, killing 10 people. The city's Department of Transportation says that Captain Michael Gansis is not cooperating with the investigation into the crash. NPR's Robert Smith reports.
Despite repeated requests from federal prosecutors, the Coast Guard, and the National Transportation Safety Board, Captain Gansis says he will not discuss the October 15th accident. Gansis says he's still too traumatized and has invoked his constitutional right against self-incrimination. As captain, he was supposed to be in the wheelhouse at the time of the accident, but other witnesses say he was off the bridge. The pilot of the boat, Richard Smith, claims that he passed out at the helm before the ferry crashed into a concrete pier on Staten Island. Now that the captain has been fired, he may face a bigger challenge. Federal prosecutors are looking into bringing criminal charges against crew members that weren't doing their jobs correctly that day. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Sales of new homes slowed in October, dropping more than most analysts had been expecting. The Commerce Department said sales of newly built houses fell by 3.5%. Dave Siders, the chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders, says the decline isn't that significant, coming after very strong sales in the third quarter.
We saw some of this kind of fence-sitter phenomenon, you know, jumping in there during the third quarter. Been expecting to see some minor sag in these numbers in the fourth quarter, and I think that that's coming together now. So I think it's certainly not a source of concern, pretty much what we expected.
Siders says low interest rates are still helping to keep home sales up. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained 5 points. It closed at 1,058. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. They Might Be Giants is a band defined by interesting contradictions. It has a cult following, but it's also reached a mass audience through its song You're Not the Boss of Me, the theme for the TV series Malcolm in the Middle. The band's songs are loved for their clever and sophisticated lyrics about unusual subjects, but They Might Be Giants also has a lot of fans who are kids. In fact, the band has a new children's book and companion CD called Bed, Bed, Bed. It's a follow-up to their recent children's CD, No. The band is made up of John Flansburg and John Linnell, who have been making music together for about 20 years. A profile in The New Yorker described them as the elders to a whole generation of smart, earnest nerd rockers. John Linnell plays keyboards and sings. John Flansburg plays guitar and sings. Their new children's book, Bed, 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 is an illustrated version of the songs on the companion CD that comes with the book. It includes this song, Impossible.
Well, they said I was impossible. Yes, they said I was impossible. And that someone who behaved like me couldn't be, couldn't be. But I knew that I was possible, not completely unbelievable. And the one they said could never be, it was me, it was me. But there's something else they didn't know. You can change your shape and you can grow out of nothing into something new, something made up into something true. Though it happens quite impossibly, the impossible turns out to be possibly.
That's Impossible, the companion CD that comes with the new They Might Be Giants book, Bed, 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 a bedtime book. John Linnell, John Flansburg, welcome back to Fresh Air. Good to have you
back
again.
Thank you.
I thought what we might do at the beginning is have you, John Linnell, recite the lyrics of the song, because the book is actually, you know, the lyrics of the songs. So let's hear how it sounds as a bedtime story.
Okay. I'll give it a shot. Well, they said I was impossible. Yes. They said I was impossible, and that someone who behaved like me couldn't be, couldn't be. But I knew that I was possible, not completely unbelievable. And the one they said could never be, it was me, it was me. But there's something else they didn't know. You can change your shape, and you can grow out of nothing into something new, something made up into something true. Though it happens quite impossibly, the impossible turns out to be possibly.
Mr. William Shatner.
I like that. I think it's like the children's version of the great American story of personal transformation that, you know, you can change.
Yeah, it's kind of our low-rent version of Free to Be You and Me, I think.
Right. So why did you want to do a children's book?
Well, you know, we did this children's record last year called No that was it was remarkably successful commercially, but it was also, I mean, we felt like it was actually surprisingly successful artistically. It was a really satisfying experience in that it was a very abstract project. It really brought us back to our kind of art school rock psychedelic roots. It was very liberating to be kind of free of all the concerns of you know, trying to figure out how to make a song that's relevant to pop radio, that's which is kind of dreary affair these days. So it was really fun, and we were approached to do a children's book by Simon Schuster. I'm not even sure how qualified we really are to be making children's books in a sense, but it's sort of like when somebody says, like, hey, you want to be in a movie? You kind of go like, yeah, sure.
We already had a song, too, even before the CD No that had caught on with kids, and I'm thinking of the theme from Malcolm in the Middle, You're Not the Boss
yeah.
of Me. And I've always wondered about that song. How come it's You're Not the Boss of Me, and as opposed to the more grammatically correct, You Are Not My Boss?
Well, it was something that, you know, it was a very popular expression in the household that I grew up in. And I think, you know, grammar and syntax are not such a big deal with little kids.
Yeah, I think that's part of the appeal of the song in a way, is that the grammar is so screwy. It gives it a special childlike emphasis.
Do you have kids of your own now, either of you?
I do, yeah. I've got a boy in kindergarten.
And my wife and I are raising two cats.
Uh-huh.
They're in kindergarten as well.
John Linnell, now that you have a child, are you more interested in writing songs for children?
Well, there's a sort of a more practical urgency to it. I realize that a lot of the material that John and I have done in the past, while we've always sort of felt like we were a band that kids could like, there are lyrics in our repertoire that I now see are pretty unsuitable for kids. So I like having the opportunity to do stuff that I can actually play for my son that doesn't scare him.
You've said that writing kids' songs has been artistically liberating, and I thought I'd play an example of a song I couldn't imagine you writing without the premise of, well, this is for kids, but it's a really terrific, it's a terrific song. It's called I Am Not Your Broom. And why don't we hear it, and then maybe you could talk about the writing of it. This is I Am Not Your Broom from the They Might Be Giants album, No.
Now, broom, you must now sweep for me, the dust it fills my room.
No, John, I will not sweep for you, for I am not your broom.
What nonsense are you speaking, broom? My words you must obey.
Another life awaits me, and I'm leaving you today. I am not your broom. I am not your broom. I've had enough. I'm throwing off my chains of servitude. I am not your broom. I am not your broom. No longer must I sweep for you, for I am not your broom.
That's I Am Not Your Broom from the CD No by They Might Be Giants, and my guests are John Linnell and John Flansburgh, the founders of They Might Be Giants. Can you talk a little bit about writing I Am Not Your Broom?
Sure, yeah. Well, that was actually written before we started putting together a record for kids.
Thus not proving my point.
I think it's an example of something there are a few songs on No that we sort of reworked to make them more appropriate for kids. And that one, I guess, we just figured would be okay, though it includes words like servitude, which I guess you have to explain to kids what that's about. Even the concept of the wage-slave broom or whatever the relationship is a little bit hard for kids to understand.
I suppose.
Well, getting back to Boss Me, I think it's sort of actually a universal theme among little brothers everywhere.
Right.
Servitude is something every family understands.
I love the song, though, because it works just on a, you know, on a literal, almost like housework level, but it's also could be like the angry lover or the angry worker.
And yeah, well, it was kind of meant to be completely literal. The song was written after I got a hold of one of these little inexpensive cameras in the shape of an eyeball that you can plug into your computer.
Uh-huh.
And I realized, like, John and I could actually make our own videos, not for $500,000, but for, you know, the $99 it cost to buy this thing. So I start out, you know, looking around the room for something to use in the video, and all there really was my broom and my face. And so that pretty much was the entire basis for this song.
Right.
In addition to writing songs for children, you're still writing whatever songs you want to write. And you just have this knack for coming up with lyrics that say things that songs don't often say, or at least they don't often say it in the way you say it in your songs. I guess I'm thinking here as an example of your song Older. I mean, there's a lot of songs that are kind of bittersweet about getting on in years and stuff, but I can't think of one that's as kind of blunt as Older.
Yeah, I think that you know, some of my favorite stuff that we've done just kind of emerges. You know, I mean, it's not that we're not thinking about what we're doing, but I think often stuff just kind of pops out, and then you make sense of it after the fact. And Older was that kind of song. It kind of felt like it wrote itself because it had this sort of weird unconscious quality.
John Linnell, were you thinking about getting older when you wrote the song, or did a clever rhyme just come to you?
I pretty much think about getting older all the time.
Do you?
In fact, I mean, the funny thing about our stuff generally is I think that John and I have a lot of anxieties and concerns that are sort of floating in the background that are just there in the songs because that's what's in our heads. You know, the music is often much happier, and I think that's one of the reasons why people think we're appropriate for their kids, even our adult material. But I mean, that's death and things like that are pretty much constant topics for us.
Yes, with song titles like Hopeless Bleak Despair.
Hopeless Bleak Despair being an example, yeah.
But what I want to play is Older. So why don't we give that a listen? And this is from the They Might Be Giants album called Mink Car.
You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're even older, and now you're even older. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still. Time is marching on, and time is still marching on. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's sooner still.
Just for the edification of your listeners, that's a Rausch fife and a sousaphone.
That's right.
Which you won't hear too often.
Are there any Rausch fife or sousaphone enthusiasts out there?
They're real ancient. Well, one of them, I guess, would be called.
One of them's a 19th century instrument that's still hanging around. One of them really is like a, I guess, from the Renaissance.
Yeah, the sousaphone is sort of an ancestor of the saxophone. And the engineer actually turned to us in the middle of the recording session and said, I know why this instrument didn't catch on. It doesn't work.
Maybe that's why there was something about the song that was reminding me of like an early chant.
Right, yeah, right.
Absolutely.
That's kind of what we're going for. I mean, it was definitely a conscious effort to, you know, create a sort of otherworldly, out of time.
Something with spider webs on it.
Yeah.
Right.
So get me some instrument that has some spider webs,
right,
please.
My guests are John Linnell and John Flansburgh of the band They Might Be Giants. They have a new book for children that comes with a CD. It's called Bed, Bed, Bed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are John Flansburgh and John Linnell of the band They Might Be Giants. They have a new book for children that comes with a CD called Bed, Bed, Bed. You still have Dial-A-Song, which is one of the early things that made the band unique. You had, John, why don't you describe it?
Well, it's basically just a phone number in Brooklyn that's connected to a phone machine, and we have a, you know, it's a like a 80s style phone machine that breaks all the time because it can't really hold up to the weight of the calls. But you simply hear a song, and the idea of it kind of came out of, you know, we came up as a band in the mid 80s in sort of a weird downtown New York, Lower East Side, East Village art and performance context. And it seemed like an interesting way to find a different kind of audience for what we were doing. We were playing in a lot of clubs at 1 a.m, and it seemed sort of unreasonable to think that a curiosity seeker would stay up that late. So this was a way to kind of reach out to them. And phone machines were really a fad at that moment. I mean, it's hard to think of phone machines as being new, but they were a brand new idea. So we were kind of harnessing, you know, just the latest technology and using it to sort of show our songs, you know, get our songs to people without having any kind of, you know, other support.
And how has the use and the meaning of the dial-a-song changed over the years?
I don't think it particularly has. I mean, it's still the exact same setup. There's only one line. It's the place where all of our material kind of gets its beginning. All the demos of songs that will eventually wind up in the show or on records or will be, you know, are doomed to obscurity all make their way, you know, first through dial-a-song. And I think that the audience has not changed all that much. I mean, originally I think it was a more local thing where there were sort of downtown New York people at work listening on their speakerphones. But I think there's still that element. There's people who call it up sort of as a way to break up their day, you know, just something to amuse them.
Yeah. Although I think the internet has kind of largely, you know, in some ways, the way people use the internet for entertainment at work reminds me, it's as if it's the biggest dial-a-song service of all time. You know, it's just a great way to get away from your job.
Yeah, but do you have feelings about free music on the internet?
You know, we give away a lot of free music on the internet. I think that, you know, it's a really complicated issue, and people have very, very strong opinions about it. You know, it's fine for us. There's so many great songwriters that I feel like are kind of having the structure of how they make a living kind of cut out from under them. It's really hard to just pretend that that's not meaningful. I think it's going to change the way. It's hard making a living as a musician in the first place. So it seems like it's kind of dreary to make it even harder. I don't know. We have very mixed emotions about it because as a band that's been giving away music for 20 years, like we're very comfortable with the idea. So it's been kind of a boom for us.
Right. The standard line up through now has been that, you know, we're benefiting more from people downloading our stuff illegally than we've been hurt by it. You know, but
right.
I don't know if that's generally, or I don't know if that'll always be. This morning I actually walked by two guys pulling New York Posts out of a newspaper box,
uh-huh.
Obviously had paid only once. So maybe, I don't know, maybe this kind of crime just dovetails into the general.
You know, the oddest thing is, you know, burning CDs is a big fad, and we often do like in-store performances where we'll do a little show and then sign stuff for people. And people have you know, started coming up to us with like burned CDs of our music for like their favorite mix of They Might Be Giants songs that they've gotten off the internet and just want us to autograph that. So they're very, people are very casual about you know, their behavior.
That they've gotten off the internet without paying
for
it?
Yeah, yeah.
And how do you lecture them, or is that okay?
No,
with you?
Yeah, you know, it's like, I mean, you know,
we glare at them.
Yeah.
Scowl.
Just silent stares. No, it's really hard. It's really hard to even get into in a way. I mean, I feel like, you know, we have a very strange, we don't have a consistent point of view about it. We like people to hear our music. You know, being a musician, there's nothing greater than playing your song for somebody. It's not like you got into it to make, you know, 0.5 cents per play, you know.
Do you copyright your songs before putting them on dial-a-song?
No. We don't even tell people. We don't tell our office or management or anything. We're incredibly,
Can you keep a secret?
That's what the show is about.
Yeah, we don't worry about any of that stuff. You know, probably the most successful song we ever did, "Birdhouse in Your Soul," like, was on Dial Song for a couple of years before it ever was released in any other form, and we were pretty sure that that Elton John was not going to be stealing "Birdhouse in Your Soul" too soon.
But say I stole it and said it was mine. What recourse would you have?
I'm sure, there'd be a bunch of lawyers would be happy to come to our defense. But, good luck with that, Terry. That's all.
One of the things I was thinking about Dial-A-Song is that it must be really liberating, as a songwriter, to have this venue where you could just, toss something off if you wanted to, put it on
there,
and see how you like it. It's
super exciting. Yeah. Although there is this aspect to the phone machine that's really deadly, which is that when you put the cassette in the machine, people start calling in, and if they don't like the song, they'll hang up in the middle. So you're immediately reminded of whatever, you might be just really digging yourself and the song you just did, and then, you pop it in, you think, they are gonna love this. And then it's like click,
How do you know that they've hung up in the middle?
Oh, because you can hear the machine rewinding before it finishes the song.
Yeah, we run the risk of, if we take that kind of thing too seriously, of trying to make more and more spectacular sounding music that maybe would get away from what we were trying to do in the first place, So become more like, Fox News or something.
Right.
All the explosions right at the top.
That would be good. They might be giants. Dial Song. 26 hours a day, 9 days a week.
Right. Oh my God.
Unfiltered
my
music.
My arms and legs are on fire.
Unfiltered music. You can handle it. So there's all sorts of things you can do.
Look forward to that.
with recordings. I don't know. We try not to pay too much attention to the front row and too much attention to people hanging up in the middle. I think, we recognize what we do is kind of fragile in a way, so.
John Flansburgh and John Linnell of the band They Might Be Giants. They have a new book for children that comes with a CD. It's called Bed, Bed, Bed. They'll be back in the second half of the show. Here's one of their early recordings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The light switch, who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul, not to put too fine a point on it. Say, I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul. I have a secret to tell from my electrical well. It's a simple message, and I'm leaving out the whistles and bells. So the room.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Mr. Slater's parrot says, coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the weird humor of the Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band. Film critic David Edelstein reviews In America, and we continue our conversation with John Linnell and John Flansburgh of They Might Be Giants.
He wants to whistle through his nose while picking up a peanut with his toes. If Johnny Morris had him on his show, you'd hear the Fuhrer's favorite say,
hello!
Hello!
Hello! Hello! Hello!
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Linnell and John Flansburgh of the band They Might Be Giants. They're known for their clever wordplay and catchy melodies. In addition to an avid following of adults, they have a lot of fans who are children, and now they have a new children's book called Bed, Bed, Bed that comes with a CD. How did you both meet?
We went to the Lincoln Public School System together outside, about 20 miles west of Boston. We really got to know each other in high school. We both wound up on the staff of the school newspaper, which was pretty much universally loathed by the student body and became this kind of clique that one of our teachers suggested we rename Vanity Fair because we were the only ones who actually read it. And it was also our sort of clubhouse, this little newspaper office. So that was how John and I got to know each other.
What were you doing on the paper?
We wrote about whatever we felt like. A lot of it was like writing record reviews and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. John was the editor. I was the photo editor at some point. I actually went to football games and took photographs of football players, not knowing what that was. There were a lot of people in the room, it's probably, working at the Promethean is probably not that different than, writing a sitcom. It was like a mob of like 12 people.
Smart alecky, yeah. High school kids.
That was a very formative time for us because, so many conversations kind of played into the aesthetic of They Might Be Giants as a band. I mean, when you're a teenager, you see a rock concert and like they bust into the, endless drum solo, you get back to the school and you talk about the concert and you just realize how much no one likes drum solos and I think that when we started the band in some abstract way we were thinking that that group of people was sort of our ultimate audience, not so much people we wanted to please but more like people we didn't want to disappoint by becoming,
that's a good way of pointing it. I think it started with we started by keeping one another in mind when we were working, but I think we always had the sort of the clique that we hung out with in high school in mind as well.
What were the first songs you started doing together? Were they originals or covers?
Most of what we're doing was kind of sound pieces and stuff. I think we both liked just playing with tape recorders and cooking up stuff and finding things around the house to make noise with. So we really kind of eased our way into actually writing songs. We started out doing much more just experimental stuff and goofing around.
Well, I thought this might be a good time to play what was, I think, like your first, hit. This is Don't Let Start.
Mm-hmm.
John, can you talk about writing the song?
This is one of those songs that is kind of in the clothing of a pop song. It's got this sort of rockin' arrangement. But the problem I've often had is I write songs starting with the music and the melody, and then I have this job of trying to fill in the words to a melody that's already written. So I end up having to sort of cram words in because the syllables fit. And that, I think, accounts for a lot of the lyrics in this one, which seem they're not exactly on point all the time. It's a song that has a strangely meandering lyric, and actually it was for that reason, when we put our first record out, I just felt like the lyrics were so oddball that we originally talked about putting it first on the record, and at the last minute I swapped it out for another one because I thought Don't Let Start was just too confusing. But people still wound up liking it, I think, because the music was so appealing.
And you know how you said you write the music first and then you have to find lyrics that fit the rhythms. Is that why it's don't let start as opposed to just don't let start?
Yeah, I think that's probably, I think you hit the nail right on the head.
But that really works, don't you think?
Sure,
not
absolutely.
Just rhythmically, but it gets to like the frustration.
Well, that's an interesting point, yeah. That's something I haven't, I don't think too hard about this stuff when we're cooking it up. But, yeah, I mean, that's certainly a way of looking at it.
That's why I'm around, to analyze it to death.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
So why don't we hear Don't Let Start. Anything else you want to say about it?
No.
Okay. So this is from the first They Might Be Giants recording.
Don't let's start. This is the worst part. To believe for all the world that you're my precious little girl. But don't let's start. I've got a weak heart and I don't get around. How you get around? When you are alone, you are the cat, you are the phone, you are.
That's Don't Let's Start from the first They Might Be Giants recording, and my guests are the founders of the band, John Linnell and John Flansburg.
I love being founders. It's a great feeling.
If like populations have become members of the band in subsequent years?
It sort of suggests,
that we're an institution.
That will carry on when we're gone as well, you know, that there will be statues of us.
In They Might Be Giants Hall.
Right.
Something to all look forward to.
No, it's a good way to describe it.
Since you didn't really set out to be performers, at least that's how it sounds hearing you talk, and it sounds like your goal in life wasn't to like be on stage. What was it like for you when you were on stage early on, and you had to find a way to be?
It was really mind blowing. I think both of us were, it was just a very different sort of. Responsibility and a different kind of response than we were anticipating. I mean, I remember our very first gig very vividly. We actually, we had, put the show together. We were working with a drum machine, so everything had to be kind of very tightly rehearsed with this. And our sort of gimmick as a band was that we had these very tricky arrangements that were very fast-paced, and the tape didn't stop, so it just was like this one long performance of very short songs. And so it was a real memory test.
There was a reason for that, too. We had this idea that if we stopped the tape or had blank spots in the tape, that people would realize that no one was clapping.
Right.
So we decided to do a show that had no breaks whatsoever.
It was a real defense mechanism. And we went up there and did the show. And immediately, people started kind of like laughing in a very happy...
That's right.
They weren't like laughing at us. They were sort of... I think they felt like they were laughing with us. But it was a very... it was just very unexpected for us. We really didn't think it was going to be that way. The bands I had been in before were kind of, we were kind of like sex bands, I mean, we just did our little rock and roll teenage thing. And, it was like there were girls dancing and all that stuff. And so this was like a bit of a departure. But, we kind of got over that and we sort of took it at face value. And we didn't say like, that's, the audience is wrong. I mean, I think what we were doing actually probably that was about the, as you know, the best thing to do with that show was just kind of laugh at it. And we sort of evolved as showmen since then, and now we're like actually shockingly comfortable on stage
and blasé,
right?
And I got the sense that it was this kind of laughter of recognition, that people for the first time we got the sense like people were actually completely identifying with the stuff we were doing, and
right.
that was a completely new experience for us, because up until then we'd just been making recordings and we'd play them for people, and it didn't have that quality of like a group of people all going, oh yeah, I know what this is about.
And I've said this before, but I felt like people related to us like they related to like their brother or their cousin. Like there's something very direct. I mean, it wasn't like they were relating to us like we were the next Mick Jagger or something, but they definitely got it in a very immediate, recognizable way.
John, you use the expression sex bands, that the band you used to play with was like a sex band.
That's, well, we weren't that like sexy,
no, but that's
but,
such a great expression. Do other people use that? I haven't heard that before, but it seems like a perfect description of what a certain type of band is about.
Well, I mean, a lot of, when you're in a band like us, you are constantly reminded that there's a whole big part of like the music business that is basically just, about, pushing very pretty people in front of very large crowds. I mean, that's a very successful way of doing it. But, rock and roll music, I mean, when we were talking about, being in a garage band or being in a cover band, you know, those, there's a social, you know, that's like teenage stuff. You know, there's a social component to that, that it's like, you know, a lot of musicians, you know, you always hear musicians go like, oh, I got into music to play in front of girls. And, you know, I was shy and it was a way for me to meet girls. And I don't know. I mean, that was, we were kind of the opposite of that. We ran away from the girls and you know, we ran into our, you know, living rooms and bedrooms and just, you know, worked with tape recorders.
Well, John Flansburgh, John Linnell, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
John Flansburgh and John Linnell of the band They Might Be Giants. They have a new book for children that comes with a CD called Bed, Bed, Bed. The documentary about the band called Gigantic has just been released on DVD. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the weird music of the Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band. This is Fresh Air. Imagine Monty Python with no pictures, the Goon Show set to music, or the wackier parts of the Beatles songbook, and you still won't have a handle on the Bonzo Dog Doo-Dah Band, a group that could only have been successful in the days of swing in London, but which has influenced plenty of performers in the years since they broke up. Rock historian Ed Ward has their story.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums, and Sam Spoon's rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. Come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone. With Roger Ruskin Spear on tenor sax. Hi, Vivian Stanchel, trumpet.
If there ever was a band so British that it was fated to have members named Vernon Dudley Bohay Noel, Roger Ruskin Spear, and Vivian Stanchel, a man, as members, it was the one that evolved from a bunch of art school cut-ups in London, who first played together in 1962. Dressed as dandies out of a Woodhouse novel and playing Vodeo Do music, and with a great affection for George Studdy's cartoon dog Bonzo, they originally called themselves the Bonzo Dog Dada Band, but somehow Dada got corrupted to Doodah. Singing turn-of-the-century novelty tunes, the weirder the better, they got to be pretty popular as mid-60s London got more colorful. The next thing they knew, they had a recording contract. Their first two singles were novelty songs from the past, My Brother Makes the Noises for the Talkies and the Hollywood Argyle's Alley-Oop, done in an oddly fey manner. But in 1967, their record company decided they'd do better with an album, and thus was born Gorilla.
There once was a very famous man. On his famous horse he'd ride through the land. The people used to see him everywhere. When he died they put a statue in the square.
Hooray!
Here comes the equestrian statue, prancing up and down the square. Little old lady stop and say, well, I declare. Once a month on a Friday.
Gorilla was a weird record, and not just because the Bonzo Dogs were a weird band. It caught them just as some of their earlier members were leaving to join trad jazz bands, and as Neil Innes, who played guitar and piano, was discovering he could write straight pop material like their third single, The Equestrian Statue. This tension between campiness and deranged pop would mark the band's entire career. Their stage act, too, became filled with odd props and pieces of art, and soon they were the in band to go see in swinging London. John Lennon came down one night and heard them, and the next thing they knew, they were performing one of their songs in the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour film.
That night, cutie called a cab.
Baby, don't do it.
She left her east side room so drab.
Baby, don't do it.
She went out on the town. No, they will make her love a frown.
Death cab for cutie. Death cab for cutie.
So someone's gonna make you pay your fare.
Death Cab for Cutie was as typical of what they did as anything. They were all over the map. And it illustrated Viv Stanchel's knack for turning newspaper headlines into songs. Their next album, which came out a year later, in the fall of 1968, was even more ambitious. The Donut in Granny's Greenhouse asked if blue men could sing the whites, or are they hypocrites, had two mini rock operas, Rockalizer Baby and Rhinocratic Oaths, and, in a rock and roll first, Roger Ruskin Spear playing a trouser press.
We'll do the trouser press, baby. One, two, three. You're so savage, Roger.
Oh, press those trousers.
Ecstasy, Bruce. Ecstasy.
John Lennon wasn't the only Beatle who liked the band. And apparently it didn't take much for Vivian Stanchel to convince Paul McCartney to come down to the studio to produce a song Neil Innes had written.
I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I've got speed. I've got everything I need. I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I can fly. I'm a supersonic guy. I don't feel pain. If you were to knock me down, I'd just get up again. I'm the urban spaceman, baby, I'm making out. I'm all about.
Urban Spaceman, produced according to the label by Apollo C. Vermouth, became a top 10 record in England. And although it hadn't charted in the U.S., the band's albums had been released here, so they began to consider touring here. They could have stayed home. They were getting work on television, and their shows were becoming legendary. But they went. The first tour was short, and there were problems. The second tour was much larger, but the problems were still there. The record company refused to promote them, and they'd arrive in city after city to find their albums unavailable. Unwilling to go further in debt, they cut the tour short, canceled TV appearances, and went back to England. Even though Tadpoles, the album with Urban Spaceman on it, had done well, the group was falling apart. Although there were six people on the album covers, the dominant figures were Neil Innes and Viv Stanchel, one inclining towards zany pop material, and the other a true British eccentric.
When Mr. Slater's parrot says, oh, a geezer likes to get one on the go. We hope to hear him smile. We love to hear him squeak. Like to see him pointing fingers in his horny beak. Sometimes he wants to whistle through his nose whilst picking up a peanut with his toes. If Johnny Morris had him on his show, you'd hear the Fuhrer's favorite say,
hello!
Hello!
Their next album, Canesim, was to be their last, although they didn't realize it at the time. You can always tell when a band's had it when they record a song about themselves, anyway.
We arrived at the gig looking rough, not happy, we'd all had enough of 8 hours on the road.
Max Lowry said he,
it's the booze of a meter, boy.
Yep, yep, yes, indeed.
And the hotel reception was empty and cold, with horrid red wallpaper 40 years old.
It sank like a rhino house.
Mr. Slater said,
oh, I can stop in the loo.
After this record, they took a break, never intending to make it permanent, but that's how it turned out. Neil Innes joined a succession of pop groups, and Stanchel had a short-lived band with Eric Clapton, followed quickly by a nervous breakdown. They still owed the record company one more album, and in 1972 they released Let's Make Up and Be Friendly, but except for a very long recitation by Viv Stanchel, Rawlinson's End, which later formed the basis for a film, it sounded like a lot of filler. Roger Ruskin Spear became an art lecturer, Legs Larry Smith is a designer, and Neil Innes has done everything from commercials for chocolate to children's television, although he's best known for his appearance as one of the Ruttles. Vivian Stanchel became increasingly odd, although he remained a beloved figure, and he burned to death in a still mysterious fire on his houseboat on the Thames in 1995.
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He wants to thank Sue Suttle Taggart for her help on this piece.
Back from his recent operation, Dan Drop, hot. And representing the flower people, Quasimodo on bells. Wonderful to hear Brainiac on banjo. We welcome Baldunikin as himself. Very appealing, Max Jaffa. That's nice, Max. What a team, Zebra Kit and Horace Batchelor on percussion. And a great favorite and a wonderful performer, all of us here, Jay Arthur Rank on gong.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film, In America. This is Fresh Air. In America is a new film by the Irish director Jim Sheridan, who's best known for his films My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father. Now he's collaborated with two of his daughters to tell a semi-autobiographical tale of an Irish family that moves to New York's Hell's Kitchen to escape the poverty of their homeland and the memory of a dead child.
When you have a holy thing happening, you don't mess with it. That's what the Irish director Jim Sheridan has said about the filming of In America, and watching the movie, I knew what he meant. The film has its clunky notes, and once or twice it edges into a sort of dopey mysticism, but I didn't mind the flaws, because In America captures the essence of a loving family in a way I've never seen on screen. This is at times a very bleak portrait of economic struggle, of cruel illness and death, and yet that bleakness is transfigured by the Afrocentric colors and the joyous filmmaking and the radiance of these actors. The movie is Sheridan's love letter to his own family, who came with him to America in the early 80s, where he tried to make it as an actor and a playwright. In the first scene, the father, played by Paddy Considine, the mother, played by Samantha Morton, and the two daughters, played by real-life sisters Sarah and Emma Bolger, slip over the border from Canada. They tell customs they're on holiday, and the oldest girl uses one of three magic wishes she claims she has to get them into the country. Then they take a tunnel under the water into Hell's Kitchen, New York City. They find an apartment building full of junkies and poor people, and the father tries to find work as an actor. The Manhattan of Sheridan's movie is neither a magical paradise nor a brutal hell. It's more like an exotic jungle. When the family enters the sprawling but trash-strewn apartment full of pigeons, the girls want to know if they can keep the birds. Although the father and mother try desperately to keep them fed and happy, the girls are lonely and without a community, and they're carrying their parents' burden of grief over the death of their younger brother, who fell down a staircase and died of a brain tumor a year earlier. Reportedly, Sheridan wrote a draft of the story and gave it to his now-grown daughters for advice. They'd been there, after all. The daughters rewrote it and gave it back to him, with the character of the father reduced to almost nothing. So Sheridan decided to split the difference. And that's one of the things that makes the movie so special, that it has so many distinct points of view. It even has another eye, the video camera of the older girl, a budding filmmaker, who gets closer to people than the more objective camera of the movie's director. Here's a scene from the middle of the film, after the two girls have been given a prize at a school Halloween fair for the best homemade costumes. Actually, the only homemade costumes.
Ah, you can't throw away your prize. Best homemade costume.
They made it up because they pitied us.
You got it because you're different.
We don't want to be different. We want to be the same as everybody else.
Why would you want to be the same as everybody else?
Because everybody else goes trick-or-treating.
What's that?
It's what they do here for Halloween.
What do you mean, like help the Halloween party?
No, not help the Halloween party. You don't ask for help in America, you demand it. Trick or treat, you don't ask, you threaten.
You can't do that in our street.
Why not?
Because you can't threaten drug addicts and transvestites, that's why.
What are transvestites? Man dresses up as a woman. For Halloween? No, all the time. All the time. Why? It's just what they do here, okay?
Sheridan has said that on every shot, he let one of the Bulger sisters call action and the other cut, and that the two little girls moved around the backstage world of the movie as if they ran the show. So it's fitting somehow that the dad in the story comes to seem peripheral. The father here is sullen and closed down. He's learning from his daughters, just as Sheridan must have learned from his own daughters, learned to let go of defenses and tricks and to go with the flow. The father on screen learns to let go of the son who haunts him, because this wife and these girls are here, irrefutable, pressing endlessly for his attention. I wish that In America didn't get so new agey in spots. There's a sequence in which Sheridan cuts back and forth between the parents making violent love during a thunderstorm, while their downstairs neighbor, an artist named Mateo, played by Jamin Hansu, destroys some of his work and dribbles blood from his sliced-up hand onto a canvas. He's terminally ill, and we later see this sequence as the beginning of a transference, of his rage for life entering the couple's new baby, who doesn't look like she's going to make it. That's a stretch, to say the least. But as Sheridan has said, there are holy things happening on screen. In America, he implies, anything is possible. And through the magic of his filmmaking, he makes it possible in America, too.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Exact Same Moon, 50 Acres and a Family by Jean Marie Laskus, author of 50 Acres and a Poodle. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we spend Thanksgiving with perhaps the greatest soul singer of all time, Al Green. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.